Well, thank you very much to ARMA for inviting me to give this lecture. I believe Roche have sponsored the event, so thank you very much for that. It's a great privilege for somebody with such thin MSK credentials as I have. I do have some. I did work at St. Thomas's as a SHO in rheumatology for a wonderful man called John Matthews, who sticks in my mind as somebody who could elicit the ankle jerk with the patient's banana. And also played the violin, not at the same time, I should say, but he was a very talented violinist. He also taught me something about presenting. So when I was an SHO, we used to do presentations, and he always said, never start with an apology, John, never start with an apology. If you have to apologise, do it at the end. So I've broken what I would call the Matthews rule of starting with an apology. I think I probably ought to start with a bit of a disclaimer, in that I'm speaking to you as myself, as a public health physician, as an academic, not on behalf of Public Health England, which is not to say that Public Health England isn't sympathetic to MSK, but I wouldn't want you to think that what I'm saying is PHE policy at the moment, although, of course, there's nothing to stop this in many ways. It's, to some extent, I need your help to try and influence my own organisation along with everybody else. But I'm absolutely delighted to be here talking about this subject, because it's a really difficult subject. I mean, actually, talking to you about it is really difficult because a lot of very good work has been done already. The sort of easy stuff has been done. I mean, there was that excellent report that Benjamin and others contributed to from ARUK about the public health and MSK, rereading it again in preparation for this, it's a really good piece of work. And in many cases, in many sense, what I'd like to think about is how could we go beyond that? What else could we do apart from what's already set out in that? And again, there's also lots of very good epidemiology around. But nevertheless, the opportunity to do something in this area is enormous. And I think that's really the thesis. And in fact, the need to do something is striking as well. And I think this group is extremely well placed to make that happen. So I'm going to start off with just a few data slides. What I thought I would do is just roughly sketch out the case, show you a little bit from the latest Label Burn disease paper, which actually just from the visualization tool. Think about what is already going on, and then think about what else needs to be done. And I'm going to do all of that in 20 minutes, so we have plenty of time for discussion. So this is a slide. It was very interesting, actually. I thought the World event that ARMA organised was really interesting, and I had a look at some of the presentations from Mark Walpert and others, and I did notice that a lot of them gave broadly the same presentation. I don't know whether you noticed that in the audience, but a lot of them sort of said the same thing. So this is my generic what Mark Walpert's whoever slide. The burden of MSK is enormous. It's enormous in general practice. Oops, sorry, I'm sticking away my secrets. Enormous volume of general practice activity. A lot of money. Apologies, this is slightly out of date now, clearly, but I mean, there are any sort of economic analysis would put MSK very high. It's a huge contribution to loss of productivity in UK PLC. Surely needs to be concerned about it, and that's increasingly important. Health is both an input and an output from work, and there's a lot to say about that. MSK doesn't exist on its own. It's very, I think, the relationship with mental health is particularly interesting. Certainly with obesity, we talk a lot about obesity, and the Prime Minister talks a lot about obesity, but I don't think he's made the connection between obesity and MSK particularly strongly. It's very, very clearly there. And in the summary, yes, it just has an enormous impact on quality of life of very large numbers of people. Something quite unusual has happened here, actually, in sort of standing aside and being a sort of commentator on public health development for a moment. What we normally do in public health is we think of ourselves as advocates for the public health approach. We go and bang on the door of people about heart disease, smoking, alcohol, whatever, and say, what you really need to do is take a public health approach, you clinicians. That's what we're sort of trained to do. But actually, this is the other way around. Here we have essentially a clinical group coming to us saying, we want a public health approach to our problem. And I think you've caught us off guard, actually. Because I think the public health community is not used to being asked to do public health. We're used to trying to sort of promote it. That's actually partly why I think this is this is so interesting and such a great opportunity because we've got such willing partners. So what is the public health approach? Now, you don't have to look at... I did my rheumatology at St Thomas's, actually, so I'm quite fond of Florence Nightingale, and she was a brilliant public health practitioner. In fact, she was probably the first proper evidence-based public health practitioner, and I'm going to give this talk at the Faculty of Public Health next year. I'm going to start with this. It's jointly sponsored with the Royal College of Nursing, so I think it'll go down quite well. And what she did was to collect... This is from 1856, she's in the Crimea, and she collected the data on causes of death for soldiers in the Crimea, and she carefully documented numbers of soldiers dying from what she called sort of natural causes, so infections, really, which is a grey area, a sort of speckled grey area, and then the numbers dying either in battle or from their wounds with the pink and the black. And she did it for each month and drew it out in this beautiful way, the so-called rose diagram. Now, she cheated slightly because the numbers are proportional to the diameter, not the area, so you get this effect, which is so she did massage it a little bit, but we let her off for that, but it presents a very effect. And she took that, and she collected the data, she described it and presented it, and then she used it. So she went and saw the generals and said, look, you've got more soldiers dying from infection and natural causes than being killed by the enemy. You're not going to win the war until you do something about your hospitals. And so they built a new hospital, the Scutari Hospital. They introduced the hygiene methods, and then she showed that the numbers decreased after they implemented the new hygiene. So it's all there, really. And that is essentially the technique of evidence-led, information-based public health. You collect the data, you present it in a meaningful way, and then you use it to influence and cause change. Another of my heroes, who is very data-driven, is Jack Wenberg, who's an American epidemiologist who is really he worked with Clint McPherson from Oxford, and he did this really careful analysis of hospital activity in small areas, and he showed enormous unwarranted variation in the numbers of treatments provided, and that led to huge changes and inspired Obama in a significant degree to change the American health system. So another example of how using data, if you have a clear story to tell and you collect the right data and you use the sort of the advocacy principle as well, you really can affect change. So trying to generate a general model from these examples, which we have now tried to apply in Public Health England. This is what we call the knowledge pathway. It's a cycle. So you start from the left-hand side with collecting the data, and that could be basic research or evaluation. It could be surveillance, if you're talking about infectious diseases, pandemic flu, whatever. Or it might be the softer intelligence from networks and experience, and what people know about what's happening from the shop floor, so to speak. In the middle, there's something about integrating different forms of evidence, doing analysis, using techniques to make those data more meaningful. And then, of course, there's the implementation, the translation of the evidence into practice. And that takes all kinds of different forms. It could be needs assessment, it could be working with practitioners to improve what they do, or it could be writing a document or just speaking to the Secretary of State. You still need to have done all of this in order to be effective at that end. And the important thing is that there's a link between the people who are using the knowledge products back to the people generating them so you can get the right knowledge. And in many cases, that's one of the problems, that there's a disconnect between the knowledge generation processes and the people using knowledge. So I'm doing that fairly because that's a sort of general model of our approach to public health. Here's another of my heroes, Geoffrey Rose. I was lucky enough at the MSc to be taught by Geoffrey Rose. And he of course, was primarily a clinician. He was a clinical epidemiologist. And I remember he was wearing a white coat. I'm sure he only wore the white coat to teach us the students, but he came in wearing a white coat as a freshman award. And his big idea, of course, is on the next slide. His big idea was that the population approach to prevention, and this is really relevant to MSK. So what Rose pointed out was that almost all health states follow this bell curve normal distribution. And there are different approaches, and generally in clinical medicine, you tend to see the most seriously affected, and you try and improve their experience, and you get them back to something like normal, and you can understand how that's originated. But actually, if you really want to change the experience of the population, what you need to do is to shift the whole curve. And a relatively small change in the average across the whole curve will make a huge difference to the overall outcome of the people, of the whole population. And the reason that's the case, which is not actually on this slide, but if you add in the relative risks for each of these stages and multiply up with the numbers, you find that although the relative risk of illness is higher for this group, the numbers are somewhat smaller, that most cases occur in low-risk people. So to summarise the population approach is that you can never reduce the incidence of most cases unless you're working down here. And it's a profound insight. His paper, just describing it, when I looked at it, it's been cited 3,000 times in the literature, so it's a great paper. So here's moving on to the global burden of disease. So global burden of disease is an extraordinary book. It's descriptive epidemiology, and it's based on the work of huge numbers, 1,000 researchers in many countries. And what it tries to do is to draw together all the available knowledge together and look at all problems at the same time. And that's both different conditions, different countries, acute conditions, chronic conditions, all put it together. And it's enormously challenging, and it requires big data analysis and some of the latest Bayesian techniques to do it. And it's been going for 20 years, and it's now at a pretty advanced state. This is my friend and colleague Adrian Davis, who really summed it up beautifully by saying, this is a new paradigm in public health. We're no longer looking at individual conditions, we're looking at everything together. And of course, it's more difficult to look at everything together, but it is actually what people need. So whether you're somebody in charge of a health service, trying to commission a health service, or whether you're an individual patient, you don't experience individual diseases one at a time, you experience everything together. So that's why the GBD, although it's complicated methodologically, produces relatively straightforward answers that people can understand and people use. So I think we're going to hear a lot more from GBD. So, now, what does GBD say about MSK, which is what you want to know? I mean, some of this, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, because I think for those of you who've been in this, you largely know what GBD says about MSK, I think, but it is nevertheless a very strong story. So if we start off, there's a beautiful visualization tool that, in fact, we help fund, which is on the IHME website. Probably I haven't got a link, but we can circulate the link, the Institute of Health Metrics and Evaluation in Seattle. Of course, it's funded by the Bill Gates, the Gates Foundation. That's why it's in Seattle. And you can do this yourself, and it's quite easy to do. I would encourage you to go and have a play with it and see where you get to. But if you look at causes of deaths, this is for England in 2013, and of course, perhaps not surprisingly, MSK really doesn't feature at all. And if you hover over these squares, you get the numbers as well. So. But it just gives you a good idea. So you can see causes of death. The blue are non-communicable diseases, the red are communicable diseases, and the green are largely sort of trauma external causes. But then when you go to disability, there we are, you've got years of disability, MSK becomes really significant. And in fact, that's 24% of the total, 24.1% of the total is MSK together. And actually nothing is as big as back and neck pain. Back and neck pain is over 20%, and nothing else actually goes above 10%. So it's a huge, and that's all years for disability. When you start, the really interesting thing, of course, is that when you start looking at disability-adjusted life years, which is a mixture of premature mortality and disability, is a sort of one of the key constructs of GBD. You find that for the 15 to 49 year age group, so if you like young working age people, top of the list is low back and neck pain. And despite the fact that there are a number of other very, very interesting changes going on, you can see diabetes has risen up hugely, drug use disorder has risen up hugely, various other things have gone down. Cancer has been a really worthwhile improvement in cancer, and that's because mortality from cancer in that age group has declined. But nevertheless, low back pain was the highest cause in 1990 and is still the highest cause in 2013, alongside, and then depressive disorders, skin diseases are underneath there. So there's really been no change at that level for those younger adults. Now, if you go on to the next age group, so the 50 to 69 year old group, like the older, increasingly the older working age group up to 69, there's been the change. So in the past, in 1990, it was ischemic heart disease and lung cancer that was the biggest burden, and low back pain was number three, but now low back pain is number one, so it's overtaken those causes of mortality. So there's a really profound change. And of course, in this age group, you've got a group of people who have much more burden. So it's a higher proportion of musculoskeletal of a much larger total burden in that age group. I mean, again, there's some really interesting changes going on. Diabetes, lower down, diabetes coming up. Road traffic accidents has gone down. So there's lots in there, but the impact of MSK has greatly increased in that age group. If you go on to the older age group, so 70 plus years, then of course, in the DALYs, MSK is not so prominent. So you now, of course, you've got some of the more mortal conditions coming in with ischemic heart disease, COPD, and so on. And in fact, in the older age group, sense organ diseases are slightly greater than low back and neck pain, which is to some extent not surprising, but there's not a huge difference there. And of course, many of those will go together. So that's down. If you look at YLDs, disability alone, leaving aside the effect of mortality for the younger age groups, then again, it's just dominated by low back and neck pain throughout at different age groups. This is the young adult age group. This is the 50 to 69 age group, 1990 and 2013. Falls is less significant than it was. Other musculoskeletal is really quite high in the 50 to 69 age group. So there we are. And that hasn't changed. It's changed a bit. The numbers have changed a bit since the 2013 paper, but broadly that's the same. It's the same picture. So the interesting thing about, so we're going to talk about risk factors. So so if we're interested in MSK from a public health point of view, we want to know why are all these people getting MSK? What can we do about it? So risk factors, this is a general model that the GBD uses. And in general, we have data about behaviours, smoking, diet, etc., physical activity. We have data about metabolic factors, high cholesterol, high blood pressure, high body mass index. And we have data about things like air pollution, environmental, and some occupational output. But we don't, in the model, we don't yet have the impact of health services. We don't yet have the impact of underlying social determinants. But we would like to try and add those in. And of course, there's some genetic things going on as well, probably, which are not included in the model. And the model is only as good as its inputs. The inputs are based on systematic reviews of the evidence. And the evidence is good, but by no means complete. So there are some questions that probably don't come out of GBD because we haven't got the research to put into it. But nevertheless, there are some quite strong stories in terms of risk factors. So we get the, when you start looking at attributable risks of years lived with disability, MSK pops up, this is this dark purple area, MSK pops up under high body mass index and under occupational risks. And there's low bone mineral density as well, causing harm due to injury. If we look at over 70-year-olds, we've still got the effect of high body mass, we've lost the occupational effect, and we've got a massive effect of low bone mineral density contributing to years of disability for older age groups. If you just look at MSK, which you can do, it all really comes out for 50 to 69 years, you get high body mass index and occupational risks. And then this is my final slide on this. If you look at different age groups, it's really a story of the different impacts of obesity and occupational risk at different age groups. And there's a sort of stairway upwards of the impact of obesity. So the total burden of MSK due to obesity is actually much greater in the older age groups, but that's just because they have a lot more burden. Whereas relatively, the effect of, because I mean, people in this age group have other causes of burden as well, sensory organ disease, etc. The people in the younger age groups who are experiencing significant burden due to occupational and obesity-induced MSK don't have many other causes of disability at that age. So there's a really significant impact of MSK in this to the later years of the working population, which, if we could address it, would, I think, have a huge impact both on productivity, but also in terms of people's quality of life. So that's it on MSK. We could talk about that. There's a lot to see in the data, but I think the message has come out pretty starkly. So what we really want to know is what to do about it. And there's a sort of standard list of things you do. Unfortunately, for my benefit, my talk, part of them have already been done. So I've got a few examples of what has been done, and then we'll go on to perhaps what might be done next. First thing is advocacy, and this is where the report came in, a very clear story about why we need to do something. So I think there's a good start to be made on advocacy, but I think there is more to be done. These are the recommendations from the ARUK report, which I think are excellent, actually. They're relatively, I'm sure the people writing at the time wanted to make them feasible, so they're relatively, let's say, targeted. A good example might be that existing programs on lifestyle risk factors should explicitly include MSK health as an outcome, which I think doesn't always happen, and would be useful to do. So in a way, these recommendations are about including MSK in existing public health activity to make sure that the MSK benefits are realised. So again, then going on to a sort of view of what would a generic public health programme look like? Well, it's got to have surveillance, and then we'll think about whether we're doing these things in MSK or not, and what can be done. So firstly, surveillance, monitoring, and evidence review. Now, this is, going back to Forest Science, this is absolutely fundamental. I'm not sure we're doing enough on that, and we, for example, only have a couple of indicators in the public health outcomes framework on MSK. I'm sure there's more we could do on that. National and local advocacy. The local government now has the lead for public health in their localities, good for discussion. How much are local government involved in this? How much advocacy do we get from local government on MSK? And what would we need to do to get a bit more? Public engagement, absolutely crucial, I suspect. I mean, the big advantage that you have in the MSK community is that there are an awful lot of people out there with MSK. So this is everyday experience for people. So I think patient power and people power is going to be central to the next phase of public health work around MSK. And of course, nowadays it needs to be digitally enabled, which is perfectly feasible. And there's this the idea of, there are campaigns, and we've got an example of a campaign, but there's participation, there's people actually doing things themselves, which has a huge impact for us and going on there. Obviously, primary and secondary prevention activity is hugely important. Clearly, based on the risk factors, we need to do a lot more on obesity, occupational health, diet, nutrition, and physical activity. That's really the story of where we need to intervene. The public health approach doesn't stop at health promotion. So there's a really strong role for public health in population-based commissioning. And this can be quite revolutionary if you really understand how to get the best impact across the population with the NHS pound. And not forgetting service improvement and redesign. So there are ways of working with providers as well to make sure you get the benefits for the right people. Looking at appropriateness, alternatives to different services. I was involved in the Clinical Standards Advisory Group report on back pain many, many years ago, that sort of thing I would definitely count as public health. And then finally, research and evaluation. The UK in general is very, I'm aware that we've got some research funders here as well, so research in the UK is very strong on basic science and on certain clinical areas. It's really not that strong on systems research and prevention research. We do some good work, but nothing like enough of it. And that's what we need. Just very briefly, what sort of thing we're raising public awareness, rather nice piece of work Public Health England do. We know how to do this, we run campaigns. They cost quite a lot of money. We spend about £50 million a year on these sorts of campaigns. And they do work, but it's relatively expensive. Martin McShane is talking about dispelling the myth that not much can be done to treat MSK. I think this is really important. This is about sort of cultural change, isn't it, with clinicians, to get people thinking about prevention for MSK. And working with the in occupational health, the NHS, this is a good, I mean, the NHS needs to start with its own workforce. I mean, this is particularly true of obesity, actually. We need some data on the NHS workforce. I think it'd be quite shocking, actually, if we knew how our own workforce relates to the general population. But we certainly need to improve MSK. I mean, the number of nurses who are off work because of low back pain must be huge. We know it's huge. Obesity. This is really just to make the point that we are doing a lot on obesity. It's a particularly difficult problem, there's no simple solution. The sugar tax alone is not the answer, despite what you might read in the newspapers. It's important for sort of giving a strong message. But the real interest to me is this obesogenic environment. And one of the most useful things we could do is reformulation of food, which is what we did for salt, and it really worked, and we used to do the same for sugar. So there's a lot to be done about obesity, but it's not easy. Informing commissioning, there's this rather nice musculoskeletal calculator that we had a modest role in, Imperial College helped ARUK with, and it just helps commissioners to understand the burden of MSK and makes the case locally. It needs to go further. I think it only covers osteoarthritis at the moment. It doesn't even cover the whole of MSK, so we need to do a bit more. This is about, and I think actually one of the most useful things will be these locally led new models of care. So this is an integrated approach to musculoskeletal disease in Oldham. And there must be an opportunity with the 5-year forward view to really present MSK as something which needs to have a completely different approach and to have much more joined up care. So this is, I think I've got another, so this is, rather wordy, but this is from the Atlas of Variation. So the other thing that we produce, going back to Jack Wenberg, is we produce the Atlas of Variation, which looks at different levels of clinical care in different areas. And as a result of that, there are some case studies which we've written up, and they do show quite remarkable differences. And when you look into them, you find that you've often got the wrong patients seeing the wrong clinicians for the wrong service. So there's a great deal that can be done in that box of service redesign. And then, of course, there's research. And there is some excellent research. This is, I think, Alan Silman's unit, or related to Alan, up in Manchester. So there's some great research, but we need more, say, systems research, prevention research. So I've got a couple of slides. I've got what are the challenges, and then what do we need to do, to summarise. And then I think that's the discussion. So the challenges of this are that there's priority fatigue. You can only really have about 5 priorities. And unfortunately, MSK often turns out to be number 6 or 7. So it just doesn't make it onto the list. And I really, we've got to do something. Someone's got to make some desperate sacrifice or do something to get MSK on the list. I really struggle with this one. Why is MSK not up in the top 5? Long-term conditions in general, I don't think really are a priority. There's something about mortality which has more of an immediate appeal to politicians, and I think LTCs just don't have the same impact. There are gaps. Inequality. We have quite good data. We have very good data on mortality. I think this actually makes the case. One of the reasons that mortality is easier to argue for is because we have the data. We need more data on MSK. There's a lack of focus for the public health activity. So you might want to hold this for question. Who do you think should be running the MSK public health activity? Where should the leadership come from? At the moment, I'm not sure it's completely clear. But obviously, your group is fantastic for the MSK community. But in terms of the wider world, I think that's a question. The specialist public health force really isn't that good on MSK. I think they don't know a great deal about it. We're not taught about it. We're taught about cardiovascular disease, cancer, tobacco, etc. We're not taught about this, and we're not familiar with it. The research funding for MSK is modest. I think the funding is high quality, it's well commissioned, but there just isn't enough of it. Now, the SR announcement tomorrow, it's going to be difficult. We're expecting a reduction in the public health grant. I don't think that's much of a surprise. We hope it's going to be something sensible. It's going to be difficult, but local governments, frankly, have been amazing in the way they've responded to the funding challenges, and I'm sure that the SR will not undermine local governments' resilience around public health, but it'll certainly make them very critical of any new work. Public Health England is probably, we've actually taken quite a big hit already, so we're not particularly concerned about spending review. We will no doubt have some sort of budget reduction, but we've already taken quite a lot of our medicine already. So I don't think spending review is a huge threat to public health for MSK, and in fact it might focus people's minds on let's try and do something really different and radical. So, well, this is my suggestions. Right, national leadership, coordination, advocacy. I mean, I'm not saying we've got the answers to these, I'm just saying I think this is what we need. And it needs to be quite strong, and I'm sure NHS England needs to have a role, but I think there are others. Some sort of equivalent to the Cancer Task Force, I don't know, something like that. I mentioned this before, major public engagement. This has got to be a grassroots exercise, I think. Again, there is some understanding about how to generate that. Many of you work for charities. You'll be very good at this. It can be done. We do need better surveys. We need regional data. We need data by social class. We don't really know what the inequalities are in the burden of MSK, which is a scandal, really, when you consider it's the single biggest cause. The other interesting thing about cancer, of course, is that cancer registries have driven a lot of public health. And so should we be arguing for MSK registers? Or at least more clinically focused, longitudinal data sets. I'm going beyond the ARUK public health report here, which said you need to include MSK in existing programmes. I think you need MSK programmes. I mean, if you've got MSK is the biggest single cause of disability, why don't we have an MSK prevention, health promotion programme? That's a question to you. I think in some ways you're being too modest about the importance of MSK. So what would it be? Well, in the modern era, it's got to be asset-based. In other words, you're not doing things to people, you're helping them do things themselves. We've got to address the physical environment. I'm going down later this week to see Michael DePres in Exeter, who's a leading academic looking at the impact of the natural environment on health. And the impacts that the natural environment has on health are on mental health and on musculoskeletal health. So I think there's a strong argument to be made there. Occupational health, clearly hugely important, so we need to be talking to DWP about this. I'm sure people are, but this has got to be core business for DWP, and the whole thing has to be holistic, because the causes of MSK are the causes of other illnesses as well. I think it's a really interesting, I think the MSK network idea is brilliant. I think we need to, as well as patient power, we need to involve the clinician, we need to stimulate sort of clinician power as well. Clinicians, in my experience as a regional director of public health, is that clinicians, if they get really organised around a region, the old regions, let's use the word, can be incredibly powerful as a lobby group, but also as a peer group to support each other. That's my manifesto. I think we need to go a bit further than we've done before. I don't have the answers, but I remain, we need the research I mentioned about it. I remain optimistic, so I'm going to leave you with this quote from Doctor Who. This is Doctor Who and Amy. What are you doing? I'm making a phone call. Who to? No one yet, it's on delay. I don't know. I don't know who I'm phoning in. So Amy says, right, I'm not getting it. Why exactly are you making a phone call? Because, Amy, I am and always will be the optimist, the hoper of far-flung hopes, the dreamer of improbable dreams. The wheels are in motion. I would commend MSK Public Health to you. The wheels are definitely in motion, and we need to continue with the dream. So thank you very much. Mm-hmm.